you are standing and expressing this at both an incredibly dangerous moment in American history, but also an amazingly possible moment. When it's white folks in pain, we understand there are systemic causes. When it's black and brown folks in pain, we ignore the system and we focus on the individual and we blame them because we lack radical empathy.
You have to say Black Lives Matter rather than All Lives Matter, because we said all men are created equal, endowed by their creator with certain inalienable rights. We said all, but we didn't mean all.
The whole history of America is the history of rich white men telling working class white people that their enemies are black and brown.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Speak Out with Tim Wise. My guest today is Megan Lindsay, a singer-songwriter with several Billboard-charting singles to her credit and a new album, Bold Like a Lion, out this year. She's perhaps best known for finishing second on Season 8 of The Voice in 2015, but most recently Lindsay was in the news for an entirely different reason. In September, she sang the national anthem at Nissan Stadium, the home of the NFL's Tennessee Titans, before the Titans game with the Seattle Seahawks. And as the final note of the song reverberated throughout the stadium, and with millions watching the game on national television, Lindsay and her guitarist, Tyler Kane, who is also her boyfriend, dropped to the field to take a knee, in solidarity with the NFL players who have been doing so since Colin Kaepernick began the practice last year, as a protest over police misconduct and racial inequity in the justice system. On a day when many players around the country took a knee or stayed in the locker room during the anthem, many of them in response to President Trump's demand that those who kneel should be fired, for an anthem singer to take a knee was particularly unexpected. She was actually one of two anthem singers that day who took a knee, with R&B singer Rico Lavelle also doing so in Detroit before the Lions and Falcons game. But for Lindsay, a white artist known mostly for her work in the country music genre, the move was especially surprising to some. Immediately, she became subject to death threats via social media, as well as praise from others who were inspired by her courage. I'll talk to her today about her decision to take that knee, why she thinks it's so important for white folks and especially white Southerners to stand in solidarity against racism, and why so many people assume, incorrectly as it turns out, that country artists are all conservatives. Interestingly, the day after our interview, Grammy Award-winning country artist Sturgill Simpson stood outside the Country Music Awards in Nashville, guitar in hand, playing incognito with an open guitar case for tips, regaling passersby with political messages aimed at Trump, gun fetishist, racism, homophobia, and fascism. Inside the awards, Brad Paisley and Carrie Underwood took some humorous shots at President Trump from the stage for his unhinged Twitter habits. And days later, in a Billboard interview, megastars Faith Hill and Tim McGraw called out the NRA and demanded common-sense gun control in the wake of the recent Las Vegas massacre, in which 58 people were killed and hundreds more wounded by the high-powered sniper fire of Stephen Paddock from a hotel window during a country music festival on the Strip. This coming March, it will be 15 years since the Dixie Chicks learned the price of progressive conscience in country music, after vocalist Natalie Maines verbalized a clear condemnation of the pending war with Iraq while on stage in London. But now, could it be that Nashville and country music more broadly is prepared to make a turn, or, at least, to demonstrate its breadth of thought and opinion on any number of issues? Might we have to begin rethinking our stereotypes about country artists and even fans? As a native Nashvillian, I certainly hope so, and I'll talk with Megan Lindsay about that and more today on Speak Out with Tim Wise. But first, a few thoughts about the week and what's in the news. Watch out. So there is a very interesting and quite revealing piece in Politico this past week. It was written by a guy named Michael Cruz in the November 8th edition of Politico.com. You should certainly go check it out. It is a piece he did on Trump voters in the state of Pennsylvania, and particularly how they are feeling about their lives and the guy they chose and voted for. It has now been, of course, 1 year since the election of Donald Trump, and so Michael Cruz, who originally had interviewed several people in PA the day after the election, went back to sort of check in and see how folks are feeling about how things are going. And as you know, this is one of many think pieces that have been issued since the election. Lots of surveys, lots of polls, people trying to figure out how many folks who voted for Trump would do so again versus how many are completely embarrassed and humiliated by their choice and have rethought it. And there have been a lot of different opinions on this. Obviously, some folks have suggested that they would rethink. I think the survey data suggests somewhere in the neighborhood of 8 or 9% of Trump voters say they would not do so if they knew then what they know now. And although that's not a lot, obviously, and for those of us who can't stand President Trump and Trumpism as a political phenomena, the fact that only 8 or 9% have rethought is distressing. However, the good news is, if 8 or 9% of those folks had gone the other way the first time, or if they were to in a re-election bid, it probably would be sufficient, all other things remaining roughly equal, to flip states like Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, Michigan, etc. So that might be enough, and yet it is still obviously distressing. And so Michael Cruz wanted to find out, as all of these other researchers have, what folks in places like Pennsylvania are thinking about the situation right now. And so he does this piece again in Politico.com November 8th. And for those of you hoping for an awakening on the part of these voters, if you're hoping for some recognition on their part that the guy they voted for, Donald Trump, is entirely unqualified, both in terms of temperament and also intelligence, diplomatic skill, judgment, you are going to be, I promise you, sorely disabused of your optimism. For those who might be hoping that perhaps they've woken up to his casual misogyny, his crude ethnic and racial chauvinism, his xenophobia, or even just his persistent narcissism and obnoxious Twitter habits, again, no such luck, I promise you. This piece, which focuses on voters in Johnstown, Pennsylvania, which is a small town in western PA, one of the many parts of the country left behind by economic recovery, is really quite revealing. It is a former steel town. It's been struggling for years during administrations, both Democratic and Republican, by the way. The first time I went to Johnstown would have been in February, I believe, of 1997. I went there for a talk at the University of Pittsburgh at Johnstown. It was a depressed and somewhat dying place then, frankly. It has only gotten worse since. Certainly has not changed for the better, whether Democrat or Republican. The steel jobs are by and large gone, as are other good industrial or union jobs. The town is dying in a lot of ways, and most recently, the opioid crisis has begun to have its way with far too many people in the community, especially young folks. It is a place from which Donald Trump received many a critical vote in what was perhaps the most critical state in his overall victory. So the piece starts out by discussing a woman named Pam Schilling. She's actually featured in a photograph on the top of the webpage. And Pam Schilling is a former union meat packer who, like a lot of folks who had jobs like that historically, is now having to settle for a job at Walmart. That's about all that's left in many ways in places like Johnstown. She is 60 years old, and tragically last year, her 32-year-old son died of a heroin overdose. When she was first interviewed for this piece, just days after the election, she, like the others in the article who were interviewed both then and now, made it sound as though Donald Trump was on a very short leash with them. If he did not deliver on his promises, particularly his promises to the people of Johnstown and communities like that, it seemed as though their support would vanish. Schilling, for instance, told Michael Cruz the first time around, quote, "He's just got to follow through with what he said he was going to do," end of quote. Well, a year later, Cruz goes back. And although the unemployment rate has ticked down a little bit, about one-tenth of a point, not much, not a whole lot, if anything, has changed. Companies are still having a very hard time finding workers locally who have the skills that they need or who can pass a drug test, because most of those who can pass a drug test or have the skills have already left. They've already moved away in search of better opportunities, especially younger folks who see very little future for them in places like Johnstown. And Schilling herself, who was interviewed recently, says this about Johnstown 1 year after the election of Donald Trump, quote, "There's nothing good in the area. I don't have anything good to say about anything in this area. It's sad," end of quote. And yet, even so, her backing for Donald Trump is utterly undiminished. She goes on to say, quote, "I'm a supporter of him 100%, end of quote. Now, not only Schilling, but the other supporters as well, all of whom a year ago insisted to Cruz that he had to deliver, are now all saying that they support him, they do not blame him for being unable to get anything done. Schilling, for her part, says there is literally nothing that could change her mind about Trump, which harkens back to the comment that you'll recall Donald Trump himself made on the campaign trail, where he said that it was unbelievable. I could go out on Fifth Avenue and shoot somebody, and I wouldn't lose any support. It's amazing. And of course, Donald Trump said that in typical narcissistic, would-be dictatorial fashion, as if that were a positive thing, as if it were a good thing to be able to kill someone and not lose the support of your fans, as opposed to viewing that as a cult-like thing. You know, that's sort of a Charlie Manson kind of thing. But Donald Trump apparently thought that was endearing rather than frightening as hell. Well, apparently he wasn't too far off, because Pam Schilling says that there is nothing that Trump could do that would change her mind about it. Now, on the one hand, before we get too distraught about all this, let's acknowledge that it is rare for anyone, not just Trump fans, but any of us, to publicly acknowledge that we screwed up when it comes to an election, right? Like, if you vote for somebody and it turns out that they, you know, let you down, or they do something that you don't approve of, it's very rare that any of us, left, right, Democrat, Republican, anything in between or to the sides of those things, is going to actually say, yeah, I really sort of screwed up. Because there's a psychological piece to this. You don't want to admit that you got took, right? You don't want to admit that you got suckered. You don't want to admit that maybe you didn't do your due diligence, right? You want to feel like you were an informed voter, and you certainly don't want other people judging you for having voted for someone, especially when that person turns around and makes such asinine, absurd comments as Donald Trump. Because now if you admit that you made a mistake, it's like saying that you're that guy, right? That you're that person, that you're, you know, just as sexist, just as misogynistic, just as xenophobic, just as racist. Very few people, I would imagine, are gonna admit it, even if deep down they are having some doubts. So the optimist in me says, well, you know, these people might not actually vote for him again. But then here's the problem. You read the piece, and you begin to see they're probably telling you the truth. They probably would stick with him. And it's not just because they say so. It's because of why they say so. Because that's the part that really gets deep and that we need to analyze. When you read the comments that these folks make to Michael Cruz in this follow-up of interviews that he did in Johnstown, it appears very clear that the things that drive the rest of us crazy about Donald Trump, right? The bombast, the anger, the lack of diplomacy, offending people, shooting from the hip, saying whatever the hell comes to his mind, the stuff that makes the rest of us cringe, that's the stuff that these people like. It is more because of his bombast that they love him and stick by him, not in spite of it. It is because of his personal style, not in spite of it, that they stick by him. It is because he makes the right enemies in their mind, and because he is angry, that is why they love him. Which means, if you think you're going to dissuade Trump voters by talking about what a loose cannon the guy is, you're missing the mark. They love the fact that he's a loose cannon. That's what they want. And what's fascinating is when these folks that Cruz interviews in Johnstown are given information, right, that contradicts what they presume to be true about Donald Trump, they don't necessarily fight the assumption. They don't push back because they don't have any counter information. They just change the subject. They engage in what psychologists call epistemic closure, where they just close themselves off to any narrative that contradicts the one they have in their head. So for instance, at one point, one of the guys says to the interviewer, he says, well, at least Trump doesn't sleep all day and play golf all the time like Obama, only to be told by Michael Cruz, well, you know, actually he does. He plays a lot of golf, and he plays more golf than Obama. To which the guy says, oh, really? Okay, well, you know, if I were married to his wife, I'd never go anywhere. Right? In other words, now he's just changed the subject. He believed that Obama was lazy, slept all the time and played golf, and Trump never sleeps and doesn't play golf. Now you find out, no, actually Trump does that more. That thing you just criticized, that thing that you just said made somebody lazy. And now you found out your guy does it. And now, oh, really? Okay, well, fine. Again, this is just a fascinating glimpse into the mentality of Trump voters. They go on to admit that Donald Trump probably cannot deliver on his promises to the people of Johnstown, for instance, to bring the steel mills back. One guy says, for instance, there's no way they're coming back, right? They all know it. They all seem to be very clear that there's very little, if anything, that can be done to bring steel jobs back. The same thing is true with the immigration issue. You know, some people are talking about how well he keeps his promises. And Michael Cruz says, well, about what? And they say, well, you know, immigration and border security. And Cruz says, well, you know, there is no wall. He's not building a wall. And then the guy says, well, it doesn't matter. I don't care about the damn wall, but at least he has the right idea, quote, keep them out, end of quote. So in other words, what these folks are saying is it doesn't matter whether he can actually deliver on any of the promises. The fact that he says the right thing, that he picks the right enemies, that he makes the right people angry, right? So he goes after immigrants and he voices this belief that they don't belong here. Even if he can't do anything to keep them out, right, with a wall, it doesn't matter. At least he has the guts, you know, to say what we think. And that supposedly makes you, in these folks' mind, presidential material. What was really interesting, though, was when the conversations that Cruz had with these folks turned to what Cruz says was like the biggest thing on the minds of these Johnstown voters. It seems as though, according to Cruz, the number one thing that they seem upset about, and therefore that they seem happy about with Donald Trump, is his reaction to these NFL protests of ballplayers taking a knee to protest police brutality, police misconduct, and racism in the justice system. They are incensed over the players taking a knee, and therefore they are heartened by Donald Trump attacking these players, suggesting they ought to be fired. And that is actually what they love more than anything. The fact that he hasn't brought any jobs back and probably isn't going to. The fact that the town is dying and is probably going to continue to do so. The fact that people are dying in their community of opioids and Donald Trump hasn't done anything about that. None of that matters. All that matters to these folks is that Donald Trump is standing up to these supposedly spoiled professional athletes. One of the guys that Cruz interviews says about the athletes, he says, shame on them. These clowns, he calls them clowns, are out there making millions of dollars a year, and they're using some stupid excuse that they want equality. So I'll kneel against the flag and the national anthem, and then Cruz says, what, you're not a fan of equality? And this is what the guy says. For people who deserve it and earn it, all my ancestors, Italian, 100% Italian, the Irish, Germans, Polish, whatever, they all came over here, settled in places like this. They worked hard and they earned the respect. They earned the success they got. Some people don't want to do that. They just want it handed to them. Now step back for a minute and let's process that comment. That is a fascinating, incredibly revealing comment, right? Because first of all, it is the same comment that you hear white reactionaries make when we talk about people who receive public assistance, who they disproportionately perceive to be black or brown, even though the data says most people who receive various forms of public assistance or government, quote unquote, welfare programs are in fact white. That's not the perception. When we talk about government assistance like food stamp programs, the SNAP program, what used to be called AFDC, what is now called TANF, the very limited cash welfare program that we continue to operate, or we think about public housing, or we think about school breakfast, school lunch. We always hear folks make this argument, right? Well, some folks just want a handout. They don't want to work hard like the rest of us, and they will regularly refer to their Italian ancestors, their Polish ancestors, their Irish ancestors as a contrast to whom? To lazy, quote unquote, poor black people. Here's a guy making the same argument, not in regard to people who are on public assistance, for God's sake. These are athletes who train all the time, year round, have worked incredibly hard to get to the point where they can perform at a professional level, doing something that is just about physically superhuman and impossible for the vast majority of us. And this guy, this angry white dude, is using the same rhetoric towards them as if they were lazy, as if they didn't want to work hard, as if they didn't want to earn respect just because they are protesting. In other words, when these black ball players remind this guy that they are black, they are not just ball players, they are black in this country, then it triggers a stereotype for him about black people, which he then applies in a freewheeling way to black folks, whether they are professional athletes or whether they are living in a public housing community. To them, it makes no difference. This is a really interesting insight into the workings of the white brain when it comes to how we perceive black people and how we perceive people who apparently do not deserve equality. It's a resentment against the fact that they make so much, right? So it's almost like if you're poor and black, these folks hate you because you're lazy and you haven't, you know, worked hard like they have. And if you're rich and black, then they hate you because they resent you and they think that you got something but you didn't have to really work hard for it, right? I mean, it's just this sort of internally contradictory, absurd, fundamentally white supremacist form of thinking. And so Cruz, in the piece, who's a little confused, right, by this guy's comment concerning NFL players not working hard and only wanting it handed to them, he says, what, like NFL players? And the guy he's interviewing says, well, I hate to say what the majority of them are. And then he stops short of saying what it was he was about to say. But then Pam Schilling and her husband, who also brought up the same issue of the football players taking the knee, they were not nearly as restrained. And so here's what Schilling says. She says, the thing that irritates me to no end is this NFL shit. I'm about ready to go over the top with this shit. We don't watch no NFL now. And then Schilling looks at her husband, Dave McCabe, who's 67. He's a retired high school basketball coach. And she says, tell him, says that to her husband. Tell him what you said the NFL is. And her husband looks a little bit uneasy, laughs a little bit, says, I don't remember saying that. His wife, Pam Schilling, having none of that. And she goes on to say, you're the one that told me, liar. And then Schilling looks back at Cruz, the reporter, talks about the NFL, what does it stand for? And Schilling says, N-words for life. And needless to say, she doesn't say N-words. She says the actual word, to which McCabe, her husband, responds, for life. In other words, these ball players who have worked hard since they were, frankly, probably children to get to the level of elite talent, athleticism that they've attained, are ultimately no better than any black person in the mind of these people. They're all the same. It's just what Malcolm X said. What do you call a black person with a PhD? What do you call a black person who's a doctor? And the answer, of course, was the N-word in America, because that is how black folks are viewed, rich, poor, anywhere in between. You know, we can cheer for them on Sundays. We can cheer for them on Saturdays in college ball. But at the end of the day, an awful lot of white folks, including these folks in Johnstown, PA, who Michael Cruz interviewed for this piece, still see them as this racial slur. Now, what does all this mean, and why is it so important? I think the reason it's important is because if they gravitate to Donald Trump because he makes these people their enemy, and he points a finger at them, and he attacks them, it has nothing to do with bringing jobs to Johnstown. It has nothing to do with improving the lives of Pam Schilling or her husband or any of these other people in Johnstown, PA. Their lives are going to continue to suck no matter what while this man is president, and they virtually acknowledge that. They basically admit that. But they still love him because he gives them a sense of power and authority and righteousness. This is all a pose. It is style. This is what I said after the election, that basically Donald Trump's election and voting for Donald Trump was like giving a middle finger to the world, or at least the people you don't like. For guys, it's the political equivalent of grabbing our balls as a performance act of political ideology. It's about saying to the rest of the world, screw you, we're the better people, you're the problem. It's about resentment. It's about anger. And in this case, when it comes to the NFL ballplayers, it's a resentment about people of color disproportionately making more money than us for doing something that we consider to be not real work. When it comes to jobs being done by professional athletes making millions of dollars, that's when we get pissy, right? When Colin Kaepernick first took that knee last year, that was the argument. How dare he? He's making $11 million. How dare he complain about America, which is fascinating and completely hypocritical, because white folks complain all the time. Donald Trump says, at least, that he is a billionaire, and his entire campaign slogan was Make America Great Again, which suggests that America sucks and he's complaining about it. That's all he did was complain about America. He's still complaining about America. He complained about other countries being able to take advantage of us because we're so stupid when it comes to trade deals. He said that we were basically akin to a third world country. I mean, these are the things that this rich white man said about America, and these folks in Johnstown and elsewhere voted for him because he said it. But if black folks complain about America, see, that's the problem. If you're black and you make $11 million a year, you're not allowed to say anything. If you're white and you're worth billions of dollars, you can say whatever you want, because fundamentally, we resent black people doing better than us in this country. Because remember, it's our country, right? There's this mix of admiration and resentment, right? We admire these athletes as long as they're performing for us, making us happy, winning games for our team. But how dare they step out of line and remind us that beneath the shoulder pads and the sweat, they're actual people who live in the world and have to deal with some of the same shit everybody else does. And so the question is, when you read this piece, how does one reach people like that? If it isn't really about whether you can bring jobs back or live up to your promises, then by definition, it can't be about economic pain, all that stuff we were being told about by those who said, oh, we got to reach out to these voters. They're in pain. We got to give them something to hold on to, right? If it's not about bringing jobs back, if it's not about living up to your promises, then it can't really be about that pain. What it seems to be about is needing someone to channel your anger and channel your pain and channel your hurt. And I got news for anyone who thinks you can reach out to people like that. Only a demagogue can sufficiently do that for people like the ones in this article in Johnstown. Only a rage-filled persona who places style over substance can really get away with it, because anything less bombastic is going to lose their interest. Anything that is rage-filled, however, anything that the Democrats, for instance, could put up that would be as bombastic as Donald Trump, the problem is that may attract a few of these folks in Johnstown if you find someone like that, but it's going to equally turn away just about everybody else in your coalition, right? And especially if what these voters in Johnstown require is an anger that's aimed at identifiable others who would also, by necessity, be part of any potential progressive or Democratic coalition. The idea that we can channel Johnstown, PA's anger toward corporate elites and away from Mexicans and away from black football players and away from LGBTQ folks and away from Muslims is mythical. They don't express rage at the companies for shutting down in Johnstown. They're not talking about the white, rich CEOs that moved the factories away. And they aren't talking about elites the way Bernie does or the way many of us on the left might. They see elites very differently. They see them as people with education who think about policy and who talk in nuance, right? They think about them as people in entertainment or sports who make too much money for not doing real jobs. They are actually more likely to see teachers as elites than Wall Street bankers, like this guy in PA just last week who threatened to kill teachers in a town in Pennsylvania who were on strike, said they needed to get real jobs and called them snowflakes. Right? When they think of elites, they're thinking of quote-unquote cultural elites, and that means to them pretty much everyone who isn't like them, anyone who isn't from a small town, anyone who has a college education, anyone who isn't Christian, anyone who isn't white. And the reality is you're not going to be able to attract voters like that without losing virtually everyone else in your coalition. So now, progressive folks have a choice to make. And the Democratic Party, to the extent they even want to be progressive, is going to have a choice to make. Do you dance with the ones that brought you? Because if so, that hasn't been the white working class for a really long-ass time. Or do you try to recruit people like the ones in Johnstown, PA, who are angrier at black ballplayers for protesting police brutality and injustice than they are at the very people who have turned their town into a ghost town and destroyed it by sending the jobs away? I think the choice is pretty clear. But you know what? Despite the intransigence of people like the ones in Johnstown interviewed for that piece, those of us on the left, we're going to keep fighting for them anyway, because that's what we do. We're going to keep working to save places like that one, in spite of the fact that the people who live there would probably never lift a finger to fight to save the people of Philly, or the people of Detroit, or the people of Milwaukee, or the people of Newark. Right? We're going to keep fighting to address the opioid crisis on behalf of their kids, even though they would probably never have done the same, and indeed did not, to address the crack epidemic or the heroin crisis in the 70s because they viewed it as just taking out black and brown folks. We're going to keep pushing to ensure that they do have health care and they do have jobs. You know why? Because we see those things as human rights to which people are entitled. We'll keep supporting those things for them, even as they keep voting for people who won't deliver them either and who view both of those things, health care and jobs, as mere commodities. In other words, what the left has to decide is whether we're going to waste time trying to attract and recruit the unattractable and the unrecruitable, or whether we're just going to go out there, defeat them, and then save them anyway from their own political choices. And let me tell you, if these folks in Johnstown, PA don't like those NFL ballplayers for taking a knee on behalf of racial justice and equity, they're probably not going to like my guest today either, Megan Lindsay, recording artist who took a knee herself after singing the national anthem at the Titans game in September against the Seattle Seahawks. I'll talk to her in just a few minutes.
Dear lady on the internet, you don't even know me yet, but you got a lot to say about my clothes. Oh, little do you know.
Dear mister, I'm so cool. You a sucker, Trump, punk ass fool. Got a lot of nerve throwing that shade. Is that how your mama taught you to behave?
But you won't get the best of me,
'cause I never let it get to me. Say it to my face, I give you the time and place. This is something you can't erase. Say it to my face.
That was Megan Lindsay along with Aloe Black from her new album, Bold Like a Lion. The song is called Say It to My Face. And although it was recorded long before Megan decided to take that knee at the Titans game and incur the wrath of many an internet troll, somehow it seems tailor-made for the moment and the way she feels about those who would condemn her for standing up against racism. Well, first off, Megan, thank you so much for agreeing to come on the show. I know it has been a bit of a whirlwind for you in terms of dealing with media in the aftermath of the action that you took at the Titans game in late September, where you took a knee, you and your partner, your boyfriend who was playing guitar, right? Who was, as you did the anthem, at the end of the anthem, which I think is worth noting. Yeah. You didn't actually take a knee during the anthem, and I think people feel that you did, and you were very deliberate about doing it afterward. You wanted to make a statement, but you didn't want to be misunderstood, and yet you were misunderstood, as as many of the football players over the course of this year and last have also been. So I wanted to ask you, I know you've answered this kind of question a million times before, but my listeners may not know your answer to it. What, when you walk out on that field, I mean, you've got, I don't know how many fans, 60,000, whatever it is, in that stadium, 70,000, which has got to be intimidating, even without any of this. Like, and singing the national anthem is got to be, no matter what, I mean, and you're a fantastic vocalist, but that's a hard song for anyone, and you don't want to mess it up. When you add to that the pressure of knowing all the politics of that moment, what's going through your mind in that situation? Are you having any doubts about what you at that moment have planned that you're going to do?
Yeah. You know, it's before all of this, obviously, I was nervous as it was, because I always am when I do the anthem. It's just like an intimidating thing to do. But, you know, I got the call on the way to the stadium that morning that they were going to televise my anthem. And I had a feeling that would happen, obviously, with the comments that Trump made the previous day. Yeah. And I just, you know what? I just knew that's what I had to do. You know, I think that I was given that moment in time and that platform to make a statement. And I never had a doubt about that. I think it was just more, it's scary. It's a scary thing to do, especially coming from my background and being, you know, a white woman and growing up in the South and being in country music, you know, it's just not what's expected of me. And so it was an intimidating moment, but at the same time I was like, I have to do this. I have to kneel in solidarity and I have to stand up for what I believe, you know, is right. And so I just did it.
And what was it specifically about, let's say, what had been going on with the protest, with issues of police misconduct? What was it about this moment in time that made that difference or that spoke to you? Or was it a combination of that? I mean, we'd also just come off of the Charlottesville stuff in August. So, I mean, these issues of race and racial hatred and inequality were obviously sort of front and center. Did that elevate in your mind the importance of doing it now as opposed to at some other time?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I think, you know, I grew up in Louisiana and I saw a lot of things growing up, and I've seen a lot of things obviously coming up in my career that, you know, injustices. And so I think the thing, you know, I think the thing that triggered me the most was watching the video, the Philando Castile video. And I think that one just really got me. It made me go, wow, this is messed up. You know?
Well, your Washington Post piece, and you may be alluding to that. It's a really powerful piece, and I will I'll post the link when we post this episode of the podcast. But yeah, this one paragraph, you said the booing, because you said there was some. The booing didn't bother me so much. What bothers me more is the silence of millions of white people every day when they watch a video of a black woman's son who was murdered simply for reaching for his driver's license. We have to do better. We have to speak, and we have to be allies. Why do you think it is so hard for some white folks to be allies in that way? Are we afraid of something? And if so, what is it that we're afraid of that in that moment, at least, and maybe throughout other moments of your life, you're not afraid of? Why is it so tough for some folks?
I think it starts with ignorance. I think you grow up in this culture where you're taught a certain thing, and then you grow, you know, and like for me, it was like I moved out of Louisiana and I went places and I've traveled and I've met people and I go, oh, wow, things aren't the way they seem, you know, and there's things that I saw growing up that I may have dismissed or thought weren't as bad as they were, I guess. And so for me, it's about growing and learning. But I feel for some people, maybe they never grow, maybe they never learn, you know, and then maybe when they're faced with that, it's so foreign to the way that they grew up and they were raised that they just don't. I don't know if they believe it or if they do, it's like, it's hard. I don't understand. For me, I've always known right from wrong, you know, but I think for some people, they don't get it.
Well, and I think you're right about it having a lot to do with the context of where you grew up, and not even just necessarily South versus other places, because God knows I've been all over the country and there is really bad racism in every part of it. And a lot of these shootings are happening in the North and you know, Eric Garner was choked on the street in Staten Island. So, but I think there is a difference between people who grow up in a provincial kind of setting where they're just not exposed to other ways of thinking, let alone other people. So I know, you know, you're originally originally growing up in New Orleans, and then your family moves to Ponchatoula, which I have some familiarity with. I've done some work in that area in the early 90s against David Duke when he ran for the Senate and ran for governor. And he had a lot of support from white folks statewide, but especially in the Ponchatoula area. And I think, you know, if you're in New Orleans, which is everything people love about New Orleans is multicultural. I mean, everything that people think about when they think of that city, food, music, fashion, culture, everything is first of all African influenced, but just multicultural. And so if you grew up in that context, I'm not saying that you can't be racist. There's certainly plenty of racists in New Orleans. But when you get outside of that context where you don't have that cosmopolitan sort of interaction with people from different backgrounds and different lenses, I would imagine that makes it a lot harder. So when a football player takes a knee, it's not just that they're, in your mind, somebody's mind, you know, disrespecting the flag or the military, which is seeming to me a very bizarre interpretation of what they're doing. But but you're actually, you're challenging their worldview about the way the world works, right? About, I think my country is X and you're telling me it's Y. Right. And I don't want to see that. What are some things that you saw growing up that you now look back on and think with the benefit of hindsight and experience and maturity that, wow, that was some messed up stuff, and maybe I wouldn't have noticed it if I'd stayed there and never gotten out and done other things. What are some experiences growing up that you had that made you aware of this?
I think one of the main things that I realized in the last couple of years, actually, I was thinking back. I blocked a lot of my childhood out because I feel like it was a bad experience for me growing up in that town and that high school. But I feel like I'm starting to recollect some things. And I realized that, you know, in high school in 2000, I graduated in 2004, we had a homecoming ballot would come out and it would be black and white. There would be a white section.
04. And there's a black and a white
section on the homecoming ballot. And they'd say, pick one black and pick two white people.
That's it wasn't even like it was balanced.
No.
It wasn't like
one and two. And I mean, and I think that, and they are still trying to justify that. I mean, I've had people inbox me. I wrote a op-ed for Washington Post and I talk about that. And I've had people contact me from my hometown and go, well, this is why we did it. I'm like, you can't justify that to me.
I'm guessing their rationale was, well, if we don't do that, there won't be any blacks voted for, right? But that's not right. That's a reason to challenge the white folks about who they're voting for.
Right.
Not as a way to say we got it. There was a school in Alabama several years ago that had those different proms, right? There was like the black prom and the white prom. And they said the same. They said, well, but if we had a mixed prom, it would just be white people's music, quote unquote. And this way black people get, instead of saying, wait a minute, like, let's actually challenge that whole thinking. But there's no sensibility
of
that.
There's no sensibility. I mean, there were cases, I remember being in the locker room before PE and in high school. And I remember this girl, this black girl I went to school with, and everybody's like, oh, she's so angry. She's so angry. And I'm like, well, maybe there's a reason, you know, why she's so angry.
Right.
And I remember one of the white girls I went to school with going, well, she's angry because she's a N-word.
Right.
And that was just normal.
Right.
And now she said that out loud in front of everybody and to this girl, to her face.
Right.
You know,
maybe she's angry because you call her that and she's living in a town where that's a daily experience.
Yeah.
Right. Right.
I just remember feeling like, I mean, do you know that feeling when you just like feel like you got hit in the stomach and you're just sick? Like that, I remember feeling like that in that moment. But obviously being like 15 or 16 years old, it's like I hadn't found my voice yet, you know,
to
say anything. And it's just like I kind of just let it go. And I felt guilty almost just hearing it and sitting there not doing anything. And so, you know, now, you know, 13 years later. And
Now it's time.
You know,
time,
you
know. What about since you've become a recording artist and you're out there and you travel, I know you've also had some experiences as an adult. So this isn't just a, again, to call 2004 ancient history makes me feel absolutely decrepit. But it's not just even that. I mean, we're talking as a professional during the course of your career, you've also seen things. What are some of the things you've experienced out there on the road that lets you know this didn't die by 04 or even by 2014 necessarily, or certainly not by now?
I think, I have a predominantly black band.
Yeah.
So I have a you know, keyboard player and a drummer who are both black. And so going out with them has really opened my eyes. And I have a lot of friends that have experienced this as well. When you go, you know, to certain parts of the country, it's like they're uncomfortable.
Yeah.
They're like, and predominantly white venues because I'm doing country music. And
right.
So I feel like with, you know, I had a gig this past year where the promoter told me my drummer was threatening. And he's like the nicest human you ever met in your life. So, right. And he, you know, he's a big black guy with dreadlocks. And she's like, oh, he's threatening and they didn't want to pay me. And, you know, we were playing a country club in South Florida.
Right.
And so I remember going out of the venue that night and we went to the gas station or something. And my two guys were in the front and I was in the back with my boyfriend. And, you know, coming back in, they, they had a million questions as to what they were doing there, why they were there, what they, you know, why they needed to come in. As soon as I put my window down and I'm like, they're with me. Oh, okay.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, it's come almost right like in. They're just shocked that there would be black musicians in a country music band, which betrays an ignorance of the history of country music and bluegrass music. Obviously, they don't know who DeFore Bailey is. Obviously, you know, I mean, I remember dating a girl years ago who, you know, back in the day, Charlie Pride's first several albums, they wouldn't put his face on them because there was a real fear about whether or not the people who were going to buy the music would buy the music. And sure enough, this old girlfriend of mine had an aunt who loved Charlie Pride and absolutely adored all of his music. And then as soon as they finally put his face on, I don't know, maybe his fourth album or whatever it was, she couldn't listen to him anymore. I mean, it was just sort of this. Yeah. And so there's this assumption, first of all, that country music is for white people, which is weird now because it seems to me the only two genres of music that have really begun to transcend and become national forms of music are hip hop and country. I mean, in a way, they don't. It's not geographically centered anymore. You know, country music is not just Nashville, and it hasn't been since Dwight Yoakam came here and they wouldn't even let him record here. And he had to go to L.A. to make his albums because he was too country. And hip hop isn't just the Bronx anymore where it starts. You know, and so why do you think people make those assumptions about country artists and about country fans? Is it just the historical geographic location of where it's started, or is it just a stereotype that people have?
I think it's a stereotype. And that's not to say, I mean, I've gone to other areas of the country. It may just be a stereotype in the South. I don't know. But I feel like I go to California and it's different.
Right.
You know, when people, there's country music fans there and it seems more mixed to me.
Yeah, right.
You know, but in the South, it's like this culture almost. It's like, you know, country music and NASCAR and all these things go hand in hand. And it's like, you know, the rebel flag is part of country music. Like that's a symbol or for country music or something. And I you know. I feel like the real country artists, like Johnny Cash coming up, and Kris Kristofferson and Waylon Jennings, I mean, they're not about this.
Not at all. I was thinking about that before the interview. I'm thinking, you know, you look at some of the legends of this genre, and it is people like Cash, and it's people like Willie Nelson and Waylon and Kristofferson and those guys, and or Dolly Parton. I mean, like last month, Dolly Parton got skewered for being on one of the award shows with her 9 to 5 co-stars, Jane Fonda and Lily Tomlin, and they took a swipe at Trump. Yeah. And folks wrote to her some of the nastiest things, like, you've clearly forgotten your church roots. So my church roots should make me vote for the guy that never went to church probably in his life? Or you forgot your small town. Oh, so the small town values are why I should vote for the real estate developer from New York City? I mean, and it's not like Dolly Parton has ever been secret about her views. I mean, Lou Harris, Steve Earle. I mean, you go down this list of people, and I think you're right. And it's what you said makes me think that maybe when you get outside of the South, it really is about a love of the music and about a love of the art.
Yeah.
And when you're in the South, there's a degree to which it's more about the statement.
Right.
Right. It's more of a cultural in your face. Hey, if y'all don't like it, you can kiss my ass or, you know, whatever Toby Keith said, we're going to put a boot in your ass. It's the American way or whatever. Like that kind of thing. It's almost like the mentality that I think for some folks is why they voted for Trump. It was just a way to flip off people that they don't like, which brings me to the pushback that you got specifically after you take this knee. So the booing, it seems, that's the least of it, right? You start getting death threats. You start getting hateful messages on Instagram. I heard you in one interview say you had to turn off your Instagram comments. Talk a little bit about the kind of stuff that you got that goes well beyond just the "I disagree with you," which is perfectly fine, and goes into this other really twisted place.
It's, you know, a lot of it was just, I mean, evil, like things I would never think to say to anyone. It's just, and scary. Like some of it was very violent, you know, as far as, you know, what they were saying they would do to me.
Right.
But, you know, it's amazing. I can't believe the anger you know, over something that was a peaceful protest that, you know, really, I think I was pretty clear in saying, you know, obviously I love the military, I love our country, I'm just not happy with what's going on, you know? And so it was really more of a statement of, hey, we need to get it together, you know? And it was just, you know, I mean, I had to contact the FBI for some of these death threats because they were scary. They're threatening my family, they're threatening my mom. I mean, and my mom's, you know, online and a big supporter of me, obviously. And so it got really, really scary. It's still scary. I mean, I played Eddie's Attic in Atlanta the other night, and the guy who runs the venue came up to me and he was like, look, he was like, I had to take it off our website because the comments got so bad. And he was like, he's like, so I'm sorry I didn't promote it more. But he was like, I just want you to feel safe here. So we're vetting everybody who comes through the door, you know, because we live in a crazy world and you just never know what someone's going to do. But it's just been, it was really hard, you know. At the same time, I'm just like, you know what? You know, you have to do what you believe is right, and you have to just deal with it. You have to deal with the craziness, you know.
Right. Well, I know you said in the it was either in the Post piece or in one of the interviews that, you know, people, in addition to death threats, people are wishing you will get cancer. Someone said you should have been executed on the field. Like, when you sit down and say, I hope you get cancer, like, you had to think about that. Like, you had to actually, that went through your head a couple times, and you were like, yeah, that sounds about right. Send, you know, or you should get executed on the field. My guess is if you were to make some kind of political statement about, I don't know, the importance of solar energy or the importance of having a different trade policy or tax policy, we might have people who push back, but you're not going to get to that level of hatred. What do you think it is about things that touch on race that bring this out? What do you think those of us who are white are going to have to really do to dig deep into that psychology and figure out how we emerge from that?
It's such a hard thing to know, you know? I mean, I think for me, like, I have racism in my family. Like, there's people in my family who are racist and use the N-word on a regular basis. And so I think, but they all love and respect me, you know? And so I think seeing someone who looks like me, you know, go out and do something like this, hopefully that starts to stir in them and starts to make them think, oh, well, Megan's a good person and she's doing this, you know?
Yeah.
You know, I don't know. I think it's got to come. I think it starts in your home, and it starts with your family, and it starts with reaching out to people that are the closest to you, because I do think it's hard to, like, I can make this blanket statement and stir things up in a lot of people, but, you know, I think ultimately, I think getting inside those situations and, like, with my family, like, them seeing me do it and go, oh, okay, well, it's close, then it hits home. Do you know what I'm saying? And I think if more people start to speak out and start to speak up and do it within their homes and within their families, I think that's important.
Right. Well, maybe it's more about you take those actions not because you're hoping to convert those people who were just so hateful that they're lost. Like, they're going to have their own little come to Jesus moment, whatever that is for them. But you're doing it as a way to model for other people who aren't those people, you know, who maybe you're sitting on the sidelines who want to say something. And I know in some of your interviews, you've talked about the fact that you know plenty of people in the industry in this town who not only are supportive of what you did, but you know their views on things, and you know they are not this stereotype that we have about folks in the country music industry. Are you hopeful that maybe by taking the stance that you have, that perhaps it will make it easier for some of them in their own way and in their own time to be a little bit more open? Obviously, there are some artists in this town who already are, but do you think it might help to touch something off?
I hope so. You know, I think that I hope it opens the door, you know, for that. I think that it's really hard in this industry because, you know, the labels and the industry just tries to, it's just this very safe thing, this country music thing. And it's very like, you can't say anything but this. I mean, I remember signing with Big Machine in 2009 and being media trained to death to not say anything I believe, to not talk about anything outside of, this is my album, this is, you know, you should buy it, this song's great, you know. And it's like turning every personal question around into something that says promotes your album, and that's kind of what they media train you to do. And you know, and it's a scary place since the Dixie Chicks did what they did. I think that changed, I think that was a moment that changed a lot of things for country music. Because I feel like it made country artists afraid to say anything.
Well, it took one of the biggest acts in the genre, and it didn't wreck them, but it certainly set them back significantly.
It shook them up for sure.
It's got to be very intimidating for folks. I know the other day I heard that the CMAs were originally, I know they backed off on this, but they originally were saying, you can't make any kind of comments about guns because of after Vegas, and you can't make any comments about politics at all.
Yeah.
Do you think that's part of that general intimidation that there's just, it's commerce over conscience?
Absolutely. Yeah. And I think that, you know, the labels and the industry folks are responsible for that. Because I think you go into this, I went into this not knowing that that was the deal, obviously. And then I get this big record deal and I have hits on the radio. And it's like, you know, I had some come to Jesus moments with my label over things that I said. And I was brought in and said, they said, look, you don't talk about this. And I'm like, okay. Like, you just don't realize that's what it is. I will say with the CMA thing, you know, notice that it immediately changed when Brad Paisley tweeted.
Right.
You know, and he's the host of the show, and he's a huge artist, you know, and he tweets that, you know, this isn't cool with the CMA guidelines in the press. And immediately they lifted it. You know, immediately it was changed. And I think that that is testament to, okay, if just some of these bigger artists would stand up and speak out, I think that change would happen. I think somebody like me, it's like, yeah, I've been around for a minute and I've had some success, but I'm not Brad Paisley.
Right.
You know, I'm willing to talk, but I'm not as influential, you know? And so I think that some bigger artists with some more power and success and just, you know, they're more well-known need to start speaking on these things.
Yeah. And well, it just strikes me that there's a marketing assumption that the industry makes that the fan base is sort of set in stone. Like, this is your potential fan base. And so if you say anything that upsets any significant portion of that, that's an absolute market loss. And they're not thinking about the fact that there's a whole bunch of other people out there who aren't tapped into you yet, who aren't tapped into whomever. I know that there were people who became Dixie Chicks fans after
that happened.
What happened. And maybe they weren't country music fans. Maybe it wasn't their thing. But they went out and bought every... Now, you know, that's not necessarily going to make up for the hit they took. But it just goes to show that you can't make an assumption that your fan base is a constant thing. If you start taking brave stands... And I'm sure there were people after this that did reach out to you and say some positive stuff. Let the listeners know about that too, because I don't want them to think, oh my God, you know, if I say something, it's all going to be negative. What are some of the positive reactions that you've had?
Well, to be honest with you, the positive outweighs the negative. I think the negative is louder, but it just, there's more positive than negative. You know, I actually have more Twitter followers than I did before, which is interesting.
And not just to troll you.
No, and not just to troll me, just because they, you know, they respect what I did. And I feel like, you know, I've had veterans reach, I mean, so many veterans that have reached out to me, and servicemen and women that have said, thank you.
Yeah.
You know, I've had guys in Afghanistan, they printed it in their paper on base and they were like, wow, they're like, I loved your op-ed. I thought it was, you know, awesome. Wow. And so it hasn't been all negative. And obviously I've just gained a whole group of fans that, you know, that didn't know who I was before, and they're just supporting me based on this. So it has been positive for sure.
I think it's important for people like you and other artists to be bold in this moment. You said in one of the interviews that, you know, this cause is frankly more important than your career. And I know people get tired of being told that they're brave, and obviously those of us who are white, we have an obligation to do this. So we shouldn't get patted on the back for it, because people of color are dying every day over this. But it still takes guts to say that. And anyone who says, I'm willing to put my principles above my career, is sort of rare these days. So where do you see this going for you? Obviously, people can't expect you to every week make some big political statement. But what are some other things that you think about in terms of ways that you could make your voice heard in the future? As a songwriter, let's say, are you thinking that you might do some songs at some point where you work in social justice themes or that kind of thing?
Of course. Yeah, I've definitely thought about that. I mean, I think for me, I'm an independent artist now. So it's like, I was on a label for several years. I've done that whole thing. And it's like, now I can do what I want to do.
Yeah.
And I can be who I want to be, and I can be myself 100%. And so it's a very free, and after doing this knee thing, you know, it's like, it's opened up the door for me to 100% be myself, you know. I think I've kind of been dancing around these issues for a long time. And so now it's like, I can finally have a voice. I feel like, you know, I'd love to do some public speaking. I'd love to continue to, you know, advocate for the cause. And, I've actually partnered with, Philando Feeds the Children, the organization that, was started in his name, obviously, to take care of kids who have lunch debts at school. And so I partnered with them on this, with this album release, to give a third of my album sales to that cause. And so for me, it's just about partnering with some organizations that are doing, you know, awesome things in this regard. And there's, you know, I have other issues that I'm very passionate about as far as LGBT mm-hmm. and, you know, women's rights and all that stuff. So I'm just to the point now where it's like, I feel like I'm moving into this position where I'm able to really advocate and talk about these things. And it's kind of a new thing for me, but I'm really excited about it because it's something I'm really passionate about, even more so than I mean, I love music. I'm a singer and a songwriter first, but it's like, even more so, it's like it makes the music mean more to me, I guess, to be able to insert some of these things that I'm passionate about.
Obviously, not all music can be message music in any genre, but it seems to me like if we had more artists who were willing to take a stand, at least it, you know, even the kind of stand that Paisley took about the CMA rule is a door opening to say mm-hmm. you're not going to sort of put a label on us that says we got to be this thing or we got to be that thing. And if your action and other actions by other folks around the country, including the football players, begin to open up that conversation so we can say to people, hey, you know, you don't have to just, as they told the Dixie Chicks, you know, shut up and sing or right. shut up and play football. This assumption that, you know, if you're an artist or if you're an entertainer or if you're a performer or an athlete, you can't possibly also have thoughts about stuff. Mm-hmm. Just on a purely artistic level, talk a little bit about your newly released album. Is it out yet? Bold Like a Lion?
Yeah, it just came out. Yeah, it's called Bold Like a Lion. And I wrote the songs over the course of the last year and a half
sure.
and finally got the record finished. But it's, you know, it really was. It's the first project that I've felt free about. Like, okay, I can just write about real things that I want to write about and I can produce them however I want. And so I feel really, I'm really proud of this album and I'm really excited about the themes that are addressed in the album as far as women empowerment
cool.
and being bold and speaking out. There, you know, there's definitely those themes within the album. So I'm excited about finally putting something out that I'm really, really proud of, that I feel like is 100% me. You know, it's actually more of a pop album than a country album.
Right.
I grew up in New Orleans singing soul music.
And, sure.
You
right.
know, so that's kind of always been my heart anyways, you know, but I think for me moving forward, just the message of the music is more important to me than what genre or box it fits in.
Right.
You know?
Well, and I think ultimately you're going to find a lot more fans who are going to attach to that mentality than they are just another, particularly if you're doing sort of pop songs, because if you're moving into popular music, even if it's somewhat maybe country inflected, mm-hmm. you know, there's plenty of pop songs about nothing.
Yeah.
There's plenty of country songs about trucks and dirt roads, and there's plenty of formulas that each of those genres will tell you that you should be singing about. And if you actually can figure out a way to make a pop tune that actually also delivers a message to whether it's young girls or whether it's LGBTQ folks or people of color or white folks as allies or whatever it is that you can do, that's a very unique thing. And that actually allows you to develop a brand, if you will, to put it back in those marketing terms, that I think in the long run is all going to be good for you. So I think there's a way we can combine our conscience and our commerce. And I think the big myth is that you can't.
Well, the thing too is, it's like, I feel like we're given as artists, we're given this platform. You know, I was in front of 16 million people every week on The Voice. It's
right.
like, we're given this platform and we're, you know, all the eyes that were on me during the anthem. And it's like, if this isn't a platform to speak out, you know, about what's right and against injustices and all of that, then what is it for? Is
right.
it just a vanity project? Because at the end of the day, like, I'm, you know, you live once, and I'm here to speak out and to do what's right. So,
well, Megan, thank you so much for doing that. Thank you for coming on the show, and you know, keep doing what you're doing, because I think it's going to make a real difference in this town. I think it's going to make a real difference in this country, and I'm glad to consider you an ally and hopefully now a friend, now that we've actually had a chance to hang out.
Thank you so much.
Awesome. Thank you.
For those interested in more information on Megan Lindsay, you can find her at meganlindsay.com. That's MEGHANLINSEY.com. Her Twitter is at Megan Lindsay, her Facebook at Megan Lindsay Music. And of course, you can find her new album, Bold Like a Lion, as well as previous recordings on iTunes or wherever you get your music. And a special thanks to all the listeners and those of you downloading the program. Tell your friends and family, please spread the word on social media. You can find us online at speakoutnow.org/speakoutwithtimwise, also on Facebook at Speak Out with Tim Wise, on Twitter at Speak Out Tim Wise, as well as Podomatic, the host for this podcast. And if you'd like to become a sustainer and patron of the program, we'd love to have you.
It's one of the ways that we can grow the program and make sure that the quality, both technically and substantively, is as good as it can be. There are two ways that you can help us out. One is to go over to patreon.com/speakoutwithtimwise and become a monthly sustainer of the program. You can do that at levels of $2, $5, $10, $20, or $50 a month. And with those donations, you'll be able to access premium content unavailable to regular podcast listeners. So that might include extra portions of my interviews with my guests or daily commentaries that I'll be recording at least 3 times a week about the day's events or week's events. Also, at higher levels of patronage, you can get signed copies of my books or videos, all kinds of different extras. So by all means, check that out at patreon.com/speakoutwithtimwise. The second way that you can support us is with a direct one-time donation at speakoutnow.org/speakoutwithtimwise. You can do that through PayPal, and especially at larger levels of donation, if you don't want to make a monthly contribution, that's a great way to do that. And there are two pieces of great news when you make a contribution to this effort. Number one, it's tax deductible. The donations are not run through my personal account. They're done through SpeakOut, the nation's premier nonprofit speakers bureau, which has been bringing progressive voices to campuses and communities around the country and really around the world for over 25 years. And secondly, very importantly, we're going to be giving a portion of our monthly revenues to people of color-led social justice organizations because we don't want Speak Out with Tim Wise to just be about the talk. We also want to be about planting seeds, both intellectual and financial, in the soil of the movement. And I'd like to issue a special thanks to my monthly patrons over at patreon.com who've pledged $20 or more each month to help support this program. For this episode, I'd like to thank Bobby Miller, Brandon Youngblood, Linda Ivey, Scott Grant, Don Francisco, Tim Abramson, Maya Smallwood, Wilma DeSoto, and Erica Sabatos. For today's episode, I'd like to thank Felicia Gustin, Jean Kayani, and Amalia Mesa Gustin with Speak Out, my producer, Jamie Lynn Moeller, and Brother Ali for giving permission to use his song Gather Round from his Morning in America and Dreaming in Color album for the intro and outro music for this podcast each week. And that is where we're headed right now. Talk to you next time.
In the poor and